Religion plays a central role in modern politics. And if you don't believe it, you can just listen to the politicians. Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992 on what he called his New Covenant platform. In the re-election year of 1996, Bill Clinton spoke about Christ in 9 different statements. George Bush has referred to America as the light of the world that the darkness cannot extinguish. During the campaign, he said that Jesus was his favorite political philosopher. And during his State of the Union address, he said, "There's power, there's wonder-working power in the American people." Politicians in both political parties actively campaign in churches and actively court the so-called religious vote. But our question today is not whether politicians should be involved in religion, as if we could do anything to stop them, but rather whether religion should be involved in politics, and if so, to what extent. Some religious groups, for example, regularly turn their pulpits over to candidates to speak. Some denominations, for example, on July 4th have elaborate celebrations on Sunday where they freely mix the cross with the flag. What role, if any, should the church play in politics? What role, if any, should individual Christians play in politics? Should we vote? Should we campaign? Should we run for office? What attitude should we have toward the political system? Now, historically, the Lord's Church has not been actively involved in the political process. Is that the correct approach, or should we be following, for example, the denominational approach? And I certainly hope you know the answer to that question before we get to it. Perhaps we should heed the warning. When religious leaders enter into electoral politics, it is more likely that religion will be debased than that politics will be elevated. That sounds kind of cynical, but does that fit what we've seen, our own experiences? As with other questions in this series, we need to turn to the Bible for answers, and that's what we'll do here this morning. In the first century, Christians were part of a religious minority. They lacked all worldly power and influence. They had none. And yet they turned the world upside down. You know, the unchallenged assumption today among many in the religious world is that all will be well if we can just get the right person into office. And yet, where do we find that hope in the Bible? I think one author said it well, and this is also on your handout. Did Jesus ever suggest by word or by example that we should aspire to acquire, let alone take over, the power of Caesar? Did Jesus spend any time and energy trying to improve, let alone dominate, the reigning government of his day? Did he ever work to pass laws against the sinners he ministered to? Did he worry at all about ensuring that his rights and the rights of his followers were protected? Does any New Testament author remotely hint that engaging in this sort of activity has anything to do with the kingdom of God? That's what one author writes. And those are some of the questions we'll look at here this morning. Let's begin with the teaser you got last week. Is God a Democrat or a Republican? You know, Article 6 of the Constitution says no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or a public trust in the United States. But of course, that doesn't mean that we as individuals can't apply a religious test determining who we're going to vote for. And in fact, we should apply a religious test to determine everything that we do. Colossians 3:17, whatever you do in word or deed, do all to the glory of God. But how should we vote? Does God have a preference for one party over another? Well, to some, the answer is most definitely yes. But let's look for a moment at those two options, Democrat, Republican. Perhaps if we look at the front runners, we could tell something that will help us answer that question. Is God a Democrat? Well, in a recent presidential debate at Dartmouth, one of the Democratic candidates, Bill Richardson, said that as president, he would refuse the honorary chairmanship of the Boy Scouts, something most presidents generally do not refuse. Well, why would this Democratic presidential candidate refuse that honorary chairmanship? Well, because the Boy Scouts do not allow homosexual scoutmasters to take the Boy Scouts and the Cub Scouts on camping trips. Well, And in fact, in that same debate, all of the Democratic frontrunners favored second graders being read stories in school about a homosexual marriage between a pair of princes. Well, let's move to the next category. Is God a Republican? Again, let's look at the frontrunners. Maybe that'll help us answer that question. Rudy Giuliani. He's not only pro-choice on abortion, he's championed gay rights. He's marched in gay rights parades. He was once on a float not that far behind the North American Man-Boy Love Association float in New York. He's thrice married. He used to bring his mistress into the Gracie Mansion there while he was still married to the mother of his son. When she threw him out, he was taken in by a couple of gay friends. Well, let's move down the list. Mitt Romney. Well, he's a Mormon. And we had a whole lesson on Mormonism and what they believe and what they teach. That God is a man who consists of flesh and bones. They teach that he came down and had sexual relations with Eve, gave birth to Adam, and that Christ is nothing and became nothing more than what we can be ourselves. We had a whole lesson on Mormonism, an anti-Christian cult. So what is the answer, Republican or Democrat? When I hear that question, I think of Joshua, and I'll let Joshua answer that question. Joshua chapter 5, starting in verse 13. And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went up unto him and said unto him, Are you for us, or are you for our adversaries? And he said, Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord am I now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? Instead of asking whether God is on our side or God is on someone else's side, we need to be asking, what does the Lord say to his servant? What is he saying to me through his word? What should I be doing? You know, Abraham Lincoln once listened as a preacher, said that he hoped the Lord was on our side. And Lincoln responded, I know that the Lord is always on the side of the right, but it's my constant anxiety and prayer that this nation should be on the Lord's side. That should be our prayer. The question is not which party God is affiliated with. I think we know that's a silly question. But rather, which party affiliates itself with God? And in today's world, the answer is probably none of them. In fact, faithfulness to Christ and his word, I think, in today's world, will make you unelectable in a nationwide election. But that discussion leads us even to a broader issue than that. Is democracy God's favorite political system? Again, you listen to many, the answer is definitely yes. Well, everyone knows that Athens was the birthplace of democracy. At birth occurred around 500 BC. It lasted about 100 years. If you go 100 years after that, after it ended, you'll find that Alexander the Great had died and his kingdom had been fragmented. And if you go another 100 years, you'll find that Greece was at war with Rome, and we all know how that ended. In fact, Daniel told us how that ended, 600 years before it happened, and 100 years before democracy was born in Athens. Daniel was writing about it in 600 BC, and he traces the history of those kingdoms through the Medes and the Persians, through the Greeks, the Romans. He tells us all that was going to happen there. But it's interesting, when Daniel's talking about that, he does nothing about the birth of democracy, which would have occurred 100 years after he was writing in Athens. He skips right over that. I think a good argument could be made that if God has a favorite political system, it's a monarchy rather than a democracy. Israel was a monarchy under God until they decided they wanted an earthly king, and then it became a monarchy under Saul and the line of King David. The church, of course, is a monarchy with Christ as our king. But, you know, even in the church, or at least particularly in the broader religious world, people have rejected Christ as their king, and they're also looking for earthly rulers in the denominations, for example. Denominations take votes to determine the truth on the subject, as if such a thing could be done. You know, truth is not subject to the democratic process. Even a unanimous vote of men against God does not mean that something, the truth has changed in any way. That's exactly what Paul said in Romans 3, verse 4. Let God be true, yet every man a liar. Everybody could vote against God, and God is still true. It has nothing to do with democracy. You know, the church is not a democracy. It's an authoritarian system from the king. Christ is our king. Yet many denominations today have adopted the democratic model. You can see them in their meetings, voting on the truth and on what we should do on X or Y, and never looking at what the Bible has to say on that subject. What we do is governed by the authority of God's word. It's an authoritarian system. Church is not a democracy. And finally, one more preliminary issue. Is America a Christian nation? You hear that a lot. You know, de Tocqueville, writing long ago, said there is no country in the world where the Christian religion retains a greater influence over the souls of its members than in America. You know, we speak of Christian nations, we speak of Christian music, we speak of Christian radio stations, we speak of Christian colleges, and on, but the Bible speaks of Christians, Christian people, Christian men and Christian women. What we really mean when we ask the question, is the United States a Christian nation? I think we either mean, was it founded on Christian principles, or does America follow principles today that are found in the Bible? I think the answer to the first question is largely yes, that we were founded on Christian principles. I think the answer to the second question is largely no, that we're not following principles found in the Bible today. You know, the Bible has much to say about governments and how they are to be judged. Psalm 33:12, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. Proverbs 14:34, righteousness exalteth the nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Psalm 9:17, the wicked shall be turned into hell, and all the nations that forget God. Well, where does America stand on this scale? You know, much of the world today associates America with Christianity. And that's not necessarily a good thing when the America they see is steeped in sin and self-indulgence. You know, the Arab world has no concept of separation of state and religion. They don't understand that at all. So when they look over here and see sin and indulgence, they think that's Christianity. You know, I believe an excellent case can be made for the proposition that America has played a major role in the providence of God as he works to nurture his church and as he works to do his work through his kingdom. A major role in God's providence in doing those things. But I also believe a strong case can be made that that providential plan is coming to an end or has come to an end. And we look around and see the America that we're in right now. You know, America was once a very fertile field for the gospel. Very fertile field for people wanting to hear and obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Does that describe the America we're in today? Where is the next fertile field? There will be one. You know, Ronald Reagan has a wonderful quote that I have on the handout there from 1984. When I read that quote, I was just struck by its eloquence and its directness. Something I miss today in our politicians. And I think that quote says well what America will become like as it increasingly becomes a godless nation. Politics in the New Testament. What can we learn? I think there are 10 principles we can learn as we study the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and what it has to say about politics. And I want to go through these 10 principles that are listed there on your handout. Number one. We learn that we must be respectful of our political leaders. You know, Paul tells us in Romans 13, verses 1 through 4, the government was ordained by God. In fact, Paul tells us the government is God's servant for our good. And when Paul wrote that, the government was very evil. But even so, it maintained law and order, it maintained peace. And it maintained that, and that is what allowed the gospel to spread throughout the entire known world at that time. It was not an accident that Rome was on the scene when the church was established. That was part of the plan of God. We see it in the book of Daniel, 600 years before the fact. That authoritarian Roman system established roads and a system that enabled people to travel and allowed the gospel to spread throughout the entire known world at that time. That was not an accident. That was part of God's plan. But those emperors were so, yes, they were evil. They were exceedingly evil. Except Peter tells us also to honor the emperor, 1 Peter 2:17. Did that command apply only to the good Roman emperors? Well, which Roman emperors would that be? There were no good Roman emperors. And yet Christians were commanded to honor them. This command does not seem to be widely followed today. You know, while it's true that today politics is vicious, it is not true that that viciousness is only a recent phenomenon. One New York newspaper, for example, regularly referred to Abraham Lincoln as that hideous baboon at the other end of the avenue. His hometown Illinois newspaper said he was worse than all the greatest butchers of antiquity. You know, belittling and denigrating our leaders has today become a national pastime, and particularly when the target is someone we didn't vote for. Yet what did Peter command? He told us to honor the emperor, and no one had voted for that Roman emperor. Why is it important that we honor our leaders? Because when we rebel against their authority, when we denigrate their authority, we are indirectly denigrating all authority. And ultimately, that leads to God's authority and the authority of His Word. We need to respect all of those in authority. We need to pray for our political leaders. And yet we can also pray for deliverance from them. There's examples of both in the New Testament. 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 3 talks about prayers for kings and for all that are in authority. We must do that. But Revelation 6, 10 is where the saints cry up to God in the face of fierce persecution by the Roman emperors of that time and say, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on those that dwell on the earth?" They were asking for vengeance against that Roman emperor, because he had been responsible for that persecution and for shedding their blood. Principle number two, we must obey our political leaders up to a point. Titus 3, verse 1, obey magistrates. We must obey those in authority. We must support the political system by paying taxes. Oh, but those taxes are used for some evil purpose. They're going to be used to fund abortion. Well, the first century, what wonderful purposes were those Roman taxes used for? And yet Jesus said in Matthew 22, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's," looking in fact at a coin with Caesar's image on it. We must pay our taxes. We must be good citizens. Romans 13 tells us there's no authority except of God. That's the same context where he talks about governments, but he says there's no authority except of God. And from that, we know that the government's authority over us is not unbounded. When the government rather oversteps the will of God, we can know that that government has gone outside the mandate of God. At that point, another principle comes into operation. Acts 5, verse 29, we ought to obey God rather than men. So again, we obey our political leaders up to a point, because God is the ultimate authority on all issues. Principle number three, and this one may sound a little strange, but we must be suspicious of government. Suspicious of government. In Luke 4, verses 5 through 7, Satan tempted Christ, and we know that one of those temptations was to offer him all the kingdoms of the world. And Satan said, "It has been given over to me, and I give it to anyone I please." Well, Jesus, of course, refused Satan's offer, but he did not dispute Satan's claim of ownership. And in fact, Satan's relation to world government is discussed elsewhere in the Bible. 1 John 5:19, we know that we are of God, and the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. John 12:31, now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. John 14:30, hereafter I will not talk much with you, for the prince of this world cometh. John 16:11, the prince of this world is judged. 2 Corinthians 4:4, in whom the god of this world hath blinded. Ephesians 2:2, the prince of the power of the air. Revelation 12:9, Satan, who deceiveth the whole world. Satan is at work in this world, and he is working through governments. He's trying to influence and sway human governments to perform and do his will instead of the will of God. These verses tell us, I think, that Satan is involved in world politics, that he's involved in governments, and he uses them to thwart God's plans. Does this surprise us? In the 20th century alone, 200 million people died as a result of wars and political conflicts. No matter how good a particular government may be by the world standards, the Bible tells us that that government is under attack by Satan, and that Satan is seeking to influence that government to do his own evil purposes. Thus, the church should never place its trust in a political system or a worldly government. And nor should we be shocked when a political system or a worldly government acts contrary to God's will. The Roman leaders of Jesus' day were grossly immoral. But you never find any surprise over that fact in the New Testament. You know, some think, well, a Christian shouldn't be involved in politics at all. But that approach would require us to retreat from the battle. And as Christians, we must never do that. We must be the salt of the earth, and that requires action in the world on our part. As Paul warned us in 2 Corinthians 2:11, we must not be ignorant of Satan's devices. If Satan is involved in fighting God with political systems and governments, then we must be there as well, standing up for God, standing on God's side. If we do not, who will? But of course, our weapons are not carnal, Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 5. And Ephesians 6, verses 13 through 17. Our political fights must be waged with the Word of God in our hands. And our involvement in politics must be in accord with what we find in that book. That must be our guide. That must be our authority. And that's why we're involved. We do all that we do to the glory of God. And that includes politics. And we're not going to retreat from that battlefield because Satan is there fighting against the plans of God. Principle number 4, we must use the political system to do the work of God, not vice versa, not use the church to do the work of a political system. We must not look to government to carry out the work of God that he has given us to do. We should never look and say, well, we don't need to do what that verse says anymore because the government's going to take care of that for us. No, that's our responsibility. But the government can be a very useful tool in helping us with our mission. I talked earlier about the usefulness of the entire Roman system that Paul used in carrying the gospel to the whole known world. In fact, we know that Paul took advantage of his Roman citizenship on several occasions. He relied on that when he needed to further the proclamation of the gospel. In fact, as evil as that Roman Empire was, and it was evil, and it was judged, and the judgment was discussed in the book of Revelation. As evil as it was part of God's plan, as I mentioned, described by Daniel 600 years before the fact. We must use the political system to do the work of God and not vice versa. Principle number 5. The church must never become divided along man-made political lines. There is one division in this world. Those in Christ and those out of Christ. And when we start making other divisions, we've gone astray. In the first century, there was constant political and cultural friction between the ruling Romans and the Jews that they had conquered. The Jews of that day were divided on how they should respond to that. At one extreme were the Zealots, who believed the Jews should take up arms against Rome, start a war, and trust God to intervene and give them the victory. Those were the Zealots. At the other end of that spectrum were those who thought it was best not to trouble the Romans at all, but rather to cooperate with them as much as possible. Matthew, the tax collector, and Simon, the Zealot, were at opposite ends of that spectrum. And yet both were apostles of Jesus Christ. One commentator said that the gulf between Ralph Nader and Rush Limbaugh would not even come close to the gulf between Matthew and Simon. In fact, historians tell us that zealots regularly assassinated tax collectors. And yet Matthew and Simon spent 3 years together working side by side with Jesus. And just as interesting, we never find a word in the Gospels about their different political positions. Indeed, we never read any direct word about what Jesus thought about their vastly different political positions. Instead, what we find is that Matthew and Simon had something in common that dwarfed those different political positions, even as extreme as they were. Is that what we find in the church today? Or do we instead perhaps find division along political lines? Do we find an attitude that to be a good Christian, you must support a certain political party, and that no one who supports the other party could possibly be a good Christian? You know, certainly a Christian must never support evil, but there's plenty of evil in both political parties to go around. You know, I probably, like many of you, believe that some political parties are more closely aligned with the biblical idea, but there is lots of room for improvement. And perhaps some may be working in other parties for the purpose of improving them, for the purpose of bringing them closer to that biblical idea. In any event, we should remember the example of Matthew and Simon. Jesus chose them for a reason, and it was not because he wanted peace at the dinner table. And yet Matthew and Simon worked together for Christ despite those vast political differences. You know, the question for us is not how we should vote, but rather how we should live. And we should be following Jesus Christ just as Matthew and just as Simon did. Principle number 6. We must stay within the political process and not take the law into our own hands. Romans 12:19, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. You know, at times the Roman Empire persecuted Christians ruthlessly. It was particularly intense during the reigns of Nero and Domitian. And in my class on Revelation, which I haven't taught here, I've taught elsewhere, I go through all the history of that and explain it about Nero and Domitian and why one was so bad and the other followed along. But it started really with Nero in its intensity. And that happened with a fire in AD 66 that destroyed much of Rome. And a rumor spread that Nero had set the fire to further his plans to rebuild that city. And to dispel that rumor, Nero looked to Christians. He said, no, I didn't start that fire. These Christians over here, they started that fire. And that really started off some of the most fierce persecution of the church. And Tacitus described the situation well in his book, his history book written about the time. He talks about Nero substituting his culprits, this sect. I mean, Tacitus didn't know anything about Christians other than what he knew at the time as a Roman. Tacitus talks about Christus, the founder of this sect, and how he'd undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius, at the time of Pilate. And he calls it a pernicious superstition, and how it broke out in Judea and it spread all the way to Rome, and how they've been responsible for this fire. And how Nero would have them attacked with beasts, and he would cover them with wild beast skins to be torn to death by dogs. They were fastened to crosses, and when daylight failed, they were burned to serve as lamps by night. This is describing our brothers and sisters in Christ, first century Christians, being persecuted and torn to death and fastened on cross and set afire by the Roman Emperor Nero. And in fact, it was so bad that Tacitus, at the end, says, in spite of a guilt which had earned the most exemplary punishment, he's talking about the Christians' guilt for starting that fire. In spite of that guilt, there arose a sentiment of pity due to the impression that they were being sacrificed not for the welfare of the state, but to the ferocity of a single man. That's the Roman historian looking at it and saying it was so bad that Romans started feeling pity. As bad as that was, there is no point in scriptures where Christians were told to fight back against that government. In fact, what we see in Revelation is they're told to stand to the side while Jesus fights for them. Now, I'm not saying it would have necessarily been wrong for someone to defend themselves in such a situation. What I'm saying is there is no example of that as we look through the scriptures. Instead, what we find are saints dying with the name of Christ on their lips. If there's any point in history where we might have expected some sort of Christian guerrilla force, that would have been the point, and yet we find nothing of the sort. Instead, the one point at which an uprising might have occurred, we find that Jesus put an immediate stop to it. Matthew 26, verses 51 and following, where Peter strikes off the ear of the servant of the high priest. We must stay within the law. If vengeance is required, and it is, it's up to God. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Number 7. We must rejoice when the government persecutes us. The Bible is very clear on that point. Matthew 5:10, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely. Falsely, like maybe they started a fire when they didn't. Luke 6:22, blessed are ye when men shall hate you, shall separate from your company, shall reproach you, cast your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. 1 Peter 4:13, but rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's suffering. Why should we rejoice when we're persecuted? Because each persecution is an opportunity to stand up and let the world know that we're on the Lord's side and that we will remain on His side no matter what they do to us. We should pray for such opportunities. Now, certainly we should be thankful to God that we're not facing the persecution the first century Christians faced. Thankful every day that we're not facing that, anything remotely close to that. We should be thankful for that. But when persecutions come, and they will, we should still rejoice that we have been given an opportunity to stand up and be known as being on God's side. John 15:18, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you, Christ says. If you were of the world would love its own. So if we're hated by the world, isn't that a good sign? Number 8, we must be fearful when the government embraces us. The government wants to control everything it touches, and the church is no exception. You hear a lot about in the campaigns about the tax reform and how we're going to have a flat tax and we're going to be filing our tax on the back of a postcard and all. It will never, never happen. The tax code is government control, and they control things by tweaking that tax code. They will never let go of that power. The government wants to control everything it touches. The day will come when the government of this country will try to tell us what we can and cannot say from that pulpit. That day will come. It has come already in other countries. It will come in this country. And what are they going to do to enforce that? Are they going to send the troops in? They're going to work on the tax code. Well, fine, you can still tell us what Paul has to say about homosexuals. But, sorry, those contributions are no longer tax deductible. And that day will come. And when that day comes, we're going to have to say, fine, we'll just give more and more and more. That day will come. And it's not too far off. I much prefer government indifference. I guess our options are government hostility. Follow that in Rome. Government embrace or government indifference. I much prefer just indifference. Just let us do our work in peace and leave us alone. But you know, some denominations, they don't want indifference. They're courting an embrace. Well, let's look and see what happens when the government embraces the church, because we can look back in history and see that also. You know, much is made in the history books about the Roman Emperor Constantine's supposed conversion to Christianity in AD 312. And yet, who changed after that conversion? Constantine or the church? Who was converted to whom? Perhaps you should ask a Roman Catholic. You know, one author described it very well. He said, in describing the switch from the persecution by Rome of the church to Rome's embrace of the church through Constantine, here's how one author described that. It is therefore all the more tragic that Christians should, in the moment of victory, forsake the revelation in Jesus for its opposite in Constantine. The church did not need the protection of Constantine. It had already taken on the empire century after century and had in the end been victorious. If Constantine had in turn persecuted the church, he too would have failed to conquer it. How was it then he was able to succeed where his predecessors had failed? How was it that by a little kindness, a word of praise here, a grant to build a new church there, he was able to induce the church to forsake what they could not be made to forsake under the threat of torture or death? The emperor offered so much beyond the dreams of Christians recently under constant threat. He offered, in effect, at least a share in the kingdoms of the world. That reminds us of a certain temptation in Matthew 4. When Satan is seen to offer such rewards, the temptation is rejected. When one comes professing to be a follower of the one God, then his offer is accepted. And once again, the Son of Man was betrayed with a kiss. Not that the betrayal took place in a moment. It was a gradual process. Gradually, the church came to have faith in the emperor, to trust him, to see in him and in his ways the hand of God. That's history telling us about what happened to the church after it was embraced by Rome, about the apostasy in the church. Beware the embrace of government. Principle number 9. We must be involved in politics, but we must not trust in politics. Acts 17:6 tells us the disciples turned the world upside down, and they did so without any voting bloc in the Roman Senate. John 17:16 tells us we're in the world, but we are not of the world. The kingdom of Christ is very different from the kingdom of this world, and that's what Jesus says in Luke 22. Starting in verse 25, where he contrasts the kings of the Gentiles and how they exercise lordship over them and their authority over them, and then contrast it with his own kingdom, where he says, I am among you as he that serveth. The authority structure, the power structure is so different. There is only one eternal kingdom. It is not a man-made kingdom. You know, in the Old Testament, religion and politics were just totally intertwined. But that is not what we read in the New Testament. The earthly kingdom of the Old Testament has been replaced with a spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of Jesus Christ, the church. And that kingdom is not of this world, John 18:36. And we have to preserve and always work to preserve that radical uniqueness of that eternal kingdom and not try to mix them with the earthly kingdoms. Because those earthly kingdoms will fall. They will fail. You know, Augustine, after he was told that Rome had been looted by the barbarians, he said, whatever men build, men will destroy. And that's true. But men did not build that eternal kingdom. It was not made with hands, Daniel tells us. And yet, as good citizens, I think we must be involved in the political process. We had an earlier lesson a few weeks back on God and the law. We went over the reasons why we need to stay involved. We talked earlier today about this is Satan's battlefield. We cannot retreat from that. But we should never trust in politics. Our trust should be in God. You know, the day may come. We talk about voting. We have a right. We have a duty to vote. We're good. The day may come when we're asked to vote between Caligula and Nero. And that day may not be that far off. But that doesn't mean we're no longer involved in politics. We must continue to pray. We must continue to proclaim the gospel. We must continue to use the political system to do the work of God. We have to remain involved. Number 10, we must not turn our ideology into our idolatry. I talked a moment ago about denominations and how some of them have these elaborate ceremonies where you... up on the big screen, they'll have the cross, and behind it will be the waving flag, and they'll be singing the patriotic songs and all that sort of thing. You know, one author wrote, if one may judge by the various commencement utterances, I think he was talking about the graduation commencement utterances, Americans have only one religion, devotion to democracy. They extol its virtues. They're apprehensive about its perils to which it's exposed. They pour maledictions upon its foes. They rededicate themselves periodically to its purposes. They claim unconditional validity for its ideals. We need to be very careful that we don't promote a political system, even one as good as democracy, to the point where it becomes idolatry. You know, C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Screwtape Letters, wonderful book, where he has a demon talk to his protege about how to get people to come to his side, that is to Satan's side. You know, how do we convert people? And here's what the demon says in that book. Let him begin by treating the patriotism as part of his religion. Then let him, under the influence of the partisan spirit, come to regard it as the most important part. Then quietly and gradually nurse him on to the state at which religion becomes merely a part of the cause, in which Christianity is valued chiefly because of the excellent arguments it can produce. Once you have made the world an end and faith a means, you have almost won your man, and it makes very little difference what kind of worldly end he is pursuing. The world an end, and faith merely a means to that worldly end. Do we see that anywhere around us today? You know, George Bush has referred to America as the light of the world that the darkness cannot extinguish. If we leave here today with only one message, let's let it be this: America is not the light of the world. And democracy is not the hope of all mankind. Romans 1:16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth. 1 Corinthians 1:18, for the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us it is the power of God. Politics is not the power of God unto salvation. We are never going to reach the world with the gospel through politics. You know, in the Bible, it's very clear that it is not through the great power brokers of human history that God works to bring about his purposes, but rather it's through those who to the world seem insignificant. You see it over and over and over again in the Bible. Like Israel of old, we in the church must trust in God rather than on human alliances and on human power. Now you read through the Old Testament, and what you find is that when Israel left God, they would go looking for others to help them. They would go down to Egypt and make an alliance with Egypt where God had not sent them, an alliance that God had not instructed them to make. And that alliance with that Egyptian kingdom, of course, was an affront to God. They were no longer trusting in God. God had told them one thing, that he would do something, and they said, well, maybe, but I better hedge my bet and go get an alliance with these Egyptians over here. And they would do that, and they did that over and over again with various countries around them. And that was seen for what it was, a lack of faith in God, a lack of trust in God. They were trusting in the power of man rather than in the power of God. You know, C.S. Lewis says, if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did the most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this one. Aim at heaven, and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth, and you will get neither, C.S. Lewis writes. Our trust must be in God, upon his word, and in his kingdom, upon his son. And we need to use the political process to further the goals of that kingdom. But we must not trust in man. We must not trust in politics. We must be suspicious of human government. And we must follow what we find in the word of God. I thank you very much for your attention here today. Thank you.